Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
I do have a question about something you said earlier in response to Jeff's question. You said that there's arbitration that's already been won. By whom and when?
By the president's personal attorneys, and for details on that, I would refer you to them.
But you're aware of them, so what more can you share with us?
I can share that that the arbitration was won in the president's favor, and I would refer you to the president's outside counsel on any details beyond that.
Did she have a sexual relationship with the president?
Yes.
For a long time, the White House had said that the president denies this, that he had no knowledge of anything his lawyer was doing on his behalf when it comes to Stormy Daniels.
You think the president knew about it?
There's no question the president knew about it at the time.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about David Dennison. Wait, who? Yes, that's the pseudonym for the man more commonly known as Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Today, I want to jump right into the show. We've been following the Stormy Daniels story for a long time, and there have been some new developments this week. The most recent sequence of events goes something like this. On Tuesday, Stormy Daniels, a.k.a. Stephanie Clifford, sued the president, alleging that the agreement she signed for hush money in exchange for her silence is invalid because David Dennison, that's Donald Trump, never signed it. And then yesterday, more news broke that Michael Cohen, who is Donald Trump's personal lawyer or sometimes called his fixer, apparently also his creditor, had issued a restraining order against Stormy Daniels, a.k.a. Stephanie Clifford, in some sort of secret arbitration, which I have a lot of questions about. And to help me sort through some of the questions about these suits is Beth Reinhart. She's an investigative reporter at The Washington Post who's been tracking this story. Beth, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I feel like I just read this suit, and it's kind of fascinating for a lot of reasons. But you get to this kind of metaphysical legal question about whether Donald Trump has a contract with Stormy Daniels. And she, through her new lawyer, Michael Avenatti, who seems definitely a touch of class compared to her old lawyer, Keith Davidson, is saying there's no contract. Donald Trump never signed it with his pseudonym David Dennison or Donald Trump. And he's got a lawyer, Michael Cohen, who's saying he didn't tell Trump about it. He paid for it with his own money. Trump didn't pay him back. The campaign didn't pay him back. So, you know, is it a contract if one of the parties doesn't know the contract exists?
I guess it's kind of like the question if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it. So I'm hearing arguments on both sides, not surprisingly. Not being a lawyer, I'm not sure which one is the most persuasive yet. But the new lawyer, Avenatti, argues in the lawsuit that under New York bar rules, a lawyer has to keep his client in the loop on all important matters. And so if Donald Trump didn't know about this, then and Michael Cohen is just acting like a rogue agent, that would violate, you know, the ethical, legal requirements of his profession. So that's sort of an interesting argument. And I think to most people who don't live in this strange world of lawyers and non-disclosure agreements, of course your lawyer tells you what they're doing and what they're up to. I think that just makes sense. But as you point out, Cohen has been, you know, silent on the question of whether Trump knew, whether he was reimbursed, where exactly the money came from. And those are still questions that we'll be looking into.
So great point, Michael Avenatti, that Michael Cohen, if he is telling the truth, situation almost definitely contrary to fact, but imagine for the moment, if Michael Cohen is telling the truth, he could be disbarred for breaking the rules about how you represent a client. You have to tell your client what you're doing. But say Michael Cohen is not telling the truth, you can't be disbarred for lying in public. Assuming Donald Trump did know all about this, which is what everyone knows, he hasn't violated any legal ethical obligation by claiming he didn't tell Donald Trump something he did tell Donald Trump, right?
I guess half of Washington would be disbarred if you got if you weren't allowed to lie in public, right? Right. And, you know, Michael Cohen has really gone silent. I mean, he's
it's about time.
Yeah,
Jesus,
perhaps.
The guy, give him take his shovel away. Stop digging.
You know, exactly. I mean, he's been known to call reporters and really give him a piece of his mind. I don't know what your experience has been in recent days, but he's been pretty underground. When we've tried to reach him, we've tried to go through his lawyers, and we have had some success with that. But Michael Cohen is definitely laying low right now, from what I can tell.
Well, I have the best kind of relationship with Michael Cohen, which is a non-relationship with Michael Cohen. He does not, in fact, call me up and yell at me. But I did most of my reporting on this story in the fall of 2016. And we did call him then, I think, but we didn't get any kind of response out of him. So, but again, sort of imagine that for a moment that Michael Cohen is telling the truth. That he did this kind of on his own. Donald Trump didn't know about it. It wasn't Donald Trump's money. It seems, separate from the question of whether Donald Trump's signature is on that contract, it seems you shouldn't be able to do that. It seems that if I were to make a contract with you that I wasn't going to tell you what I knew about Subject X, and Subject X didn't know I was making that contract with you, that doesn't seem like it'd be a valid contract. If I put Jason's my producer here, if I put his name all over this contract and compelled him to do things and he didn't even know about it, that can't be a valid contract, can it?
I mean, I think, you know, that's kind of what I said earlier about it not making sense. But I think I've also heard people say, you know, that's why we hire lawyers, to do things on our behalf. So, you know, if you had told me this is the way Stormy Daniels would try to force this conversation to keep going and keep her name out there through a lawsuit that said this, because there was no signature, I didn't see this coming. I don't know if you did, but
absolutely not. But just to narrate what happened, it's sort of now clear what did happen. So after this story broke, the Wall Street Journal broke it. Those of us who had some ancillary details added them. And at that point, Stormy Daniels, because Michael Cohen commented and denied it, she said she now felt that she was free to – she felt that the agreement was no longer valid and she was free to speak her mind and she was going to do that. So at that point, we knew that. What we didn't know was at that point, Michael Cohen tried to invoke this binding arbitration – secret arbitration clause in the agreement. He took her to an arbitrator, and who knew these secret arbitration panels or judges even existed? Maybe you did. I didn't know how this worked. But he took her to this, and at the end of last week, on February 27th, he got a temporary restraining order, which said, no, you cannot say anything about this. And if you, now that they've come out with a contract, if she does violate its terms, she is subject not only to having to repay $130,000, but to $1 million damages per event. I mean, it's extremely draconian. So she has real reason to try to be within her legal rights when she does speak. And she's sort of using the lawsuit to answer the restraining order. right?
Right, right. I think that that was her answer. And first she sued, and then her lawyer, you know, went on television from early in the morning to late at night. And so not only is this going to be hashed out in a court of law, but also in the court of public opinion, so to speak. I mean, they've really thrust it into the public domain. And it was interesting the way White House Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders did that also yesterday, contributed to that by claiming, you know, victory in the arbitration. Most of the reporters at the briefing had no idea what she was talking about. But so by the, her use of the word arbitration, which, as you point out, is this like secret confidential thing most people don't even know it exists. Oh, well, now everybody knows it exists because the White House press secretary just said it on live television.
And she's acknowledging the part of the arbitration is Essential Consultants, which is Michael Cohen's Delaware corporation set up to pay this money to Stormy Daniels. So she is acknowledging in that, at the very least, that they're represented by Michael Cohen in this case. And it's a short hop from that to saying, well, all right, what were you paying? Why are you a party to this agreement? You're essentially acknowledging this happened.
Right. Now, Stormy's lawyer, Michael Avenatti, says the agreement isn't valid, so the arbitration isn't valid. But if you think the agreement is valid, you know, it does say if there's a dispute, then we're going to go to private arbitration. These are the two firms. We're going to work with one of them. And in fact, that's what Cohen did. So if you buy his argument that the contract is alive, he does appear to be within his rights to go to arbitration and get the restraining order that he was able to get.
We're back to the metaphysics. If the contract didn't really exist, then the arbitration didn't really happen. It may have happened, but it doesn't matter. What happened at this arbitration? Is this did Michael Cohen go before an arbitrator physically in person? Did Stormy Daniels, in her suit, she complains that she didn't get notice of the arbitration? Did she even know there was going to be? She and her lawyer have a chance to make their case before the arbitrator? And what the hell is that process like?
It is strange. They claim they were not notified, and that just hours later, this temporary restraining order came out. I'm sure I imagine they will have a chance to get back in there. And it is temporary. This isn't a permanent, and this isn't the end of it. It isn't, as Michael Avenatti said many times yesterday, this isn't on the merits. So it's only a step in the direction that Michael Cohen wants to go in.
But what powers does this sort of arbitration judge have? I mean, this is a private arbitration service, right? I mean, can they assess?
Yes.
Can they assess penalties and fines? They can't hold you in contempt and send you to jail. What can this judge do?
I think we're all going to be learning a lot more about arbitration in the coming weeks, and that's also, you know, kind of goes back to what I was saying about how this is this intimate, private affair. Non-disclosure agreement meant to silence the parties. In fact, there's some interesting clauses in the agreement, like they were never supposed to have any contact with each other. There's a long list of things that she's never allowed to discuss. Private information, never talk about his family.
Things, you know, he said about his family. I mean,
yeah.
It's sort of tantalizing because it suggests that he told her stuff.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So it's everything is on the down low. And now everything has obviously been burst out into the open. And part of that, or a big part of that, is a credit to the journal breaking the story to begin with.
But let's just pause for a minute to talk about how crazy it is that there is a secret court and someone can go to it secretly, mm-hmm. without even notifying the other side necessarily.
Right.
And get a secret restraining order. I mean, it's like the first time someone told me there was a thing called the dark web. I was like, what's the dark web? They're like, well, it's another internet, but it's all secret. And I was like, how do I go there? And they're like, well, it's complicated. It's like there's a whole underground universe paralleling the one we thought we lived in.
Who knew?
And it sounds, so many things about it just sound wrong.
Well, but in a way, it's a brilliant strategy on the part of the lawyers for the accused, who are increasingly using this process. You know, first, and I'm not suggesting that Stormy Daniels is a Me Too victim of, you know, she's never said anything other than that this was not consensual. But in that, context, when you have women who, in many cases, are afraid to come forward with accusations of sexual harassment or misconduct, and when they do, I'm told that arbitration and these non-disclosure agreements is increasingly becoming the preferred vehicles, because it allows the accuser to continue to keep this under wraps. And, you know, let's face it, the victims in many cases aren't eager to have this whole, all this dirty laundry aired publicly. And so it's an interesting legal strategy.
Is this the same system that, say, Harvey Weinstein might have been using with his victims with whom he signed confidentiality agreements? I mean, is this process why people are so afraid to speak out after they've made an agreement like this, that you can go to one of these arbitrators and get a judgment in secret?
Well, I hadn't written about the Weinstein case, and I don't remember exactly the details, but certainly a lot of these non-disclosure agreements carry heavy, heavy penalties. And when the accuser is someone litigious and rich, like Harvey Weinstein or Donald Trump, people are obviously nervous of getting in a fight with those folks and breaking and violating those agreements. And that's why really those Weinstein stories were so amazing, because in some cases people did violate those agreements.
Let's talk about Stormy Daniels for a minute. So, I did actually speak to her more than once back in 2016. And one of the things that struck me since these revelations have been coming out is how consistent her story has been. So everything that she told me in 2016 was confirmed, although there with more detail, in this In Touch story that nobody mm-hmm. knew about, where she'd given an interview in 2011. And then in this lawsuit now, it's all consistent. Nothing Michael Cohen says seems to be true from minute to minute, and same with Donald Trump. But Stormy Daniels, I mean, if you're trying to assess credibility here and who to believe,
right,
it's pretty hard to be that consistent if you're not going back to basic facts that are true.
Plus, I mean, if she was going to make up a tale, I think it would include a lot more salacious details. I mean, apparently they only had sex one time, and it sounds like most.
I was a little less clear on that. Can we stop on that point? Because that was the one point of variance. She may not have said this explicitly to me, but she left me with the impression that they'd had sex four times. And I saw in the Washington Post story that it said the only one time. Can you clear that up for us?
I don't know if I can. But I thought that she said, I guess in the In Touch interview, that it was just the one time. And then their other times together sometimes were in public with other people or over the phone, and not really intimate situations.
Well, that might be consistent. She definitely told me she met him these other times, but
right.
It was not. It may have been left as an implication rather than
right.
a clear conclusion.
Sometimes it's,
the definition of is may be relevant.
Well,
here.
That and also it's really hard, at least for me, to keep everything straight. wait, are we talking about Stormy Daniels? Or are we talking about Karen McDougal?
The 17 other women he hooked up with at the Lake Tahoe golf tournament
right,
in 2006.
Right. Yeah. Who's that person's lawyer again? Oh, no. That was 2006. Okay. It's just, it's a lot going on here.
So at this point, Beth, there's no real dispute about him having an affair with her. I mean, he's not even maintaining it. Sarah Huckabee Sanders isn't maintaining it. They're just hanging it on some technical denial. I'm afraid we're going to be pretty quickly back to the point, of course he did, but nobody cares.
Well, I think that also goes to a question I've had, which is $130,000, that's it. But I think what I've been told is, you get what the market will bear. And Donald Trump was a known philanderer who had a long list of women accusing him of non-consensual relationships. And at least before he was president of the United States, $130,000 is about what her silence was worth. So I think you're right. I mean, Trump's reputation and the way we know he talks about women certainly plays into our view of this affair.
Yeah, well, you know, 130,000 here, 130,000 there, it adds up. I mean, based on, we don't really know much about, you know, his real net worth. That could be 50% of it for all we know.
And, you know, we now know of two situations in which women who claim to have slept with Donald Trump were paid. We don't know that that's the end of it on that point. And that's certainly a question that we'll continue looking at.
You know, there was a devastating line in the Washington Post, the other Washington Post story today, describing what happened at this meeting at Lake Tahoe. It describes it as an unremarkable hookup between two people in the outer orbits of Hollywood fame. Daniels was the star of adult movies. Trump's reality show, The Apprentice, was slumping. At this Lake Tahoe tournament, the organizers had given him only fifth billing, listing the real estate developer two spots below Ray Romano in their lineup of stars. Now, that was just, that's just calculated to wound. That's just, you're just trying to hurt the guy there.
Well, he's president of the United States. He can take it.
He can take it. Yeah, you know what gets to him. All right. I've been speaking to Beth Reinhardt of the Washington Post investigative unit. Beth, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Trumpcast was produced by Jason DeLeon. You can find us at Twitter at RealTrumpcast. And hey, you know, another show you should be following is Studio 360. I went on the podcast this week with my brother, Joe Weisberg. He's the creator of The Americans. And we had a really good time talking to Kurt Anderson about Trumpcast, about The Americans, about spies, Russia. I think you'll enjoy it. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast.